Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. Over the next 60 minutes, you'll hear some of the top stories and features of the past week from our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Here's Ira Melman.
Hong Kong's protests have received worldwide attention, but perhaps nowhere has the pro-democracy movement resonated more powerfully than in nearby Taiwan. The self-ruled island, which is claimed by China, has become a source of solidarity and refuge for Hong Kong, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Taipei.
What happens today in Hong Kong could happen tomorrow in Taiwan. That's the concern at this Lenin Wall set up in support of Hong Kong's protests.
This is a reminder that one country, two systems is a lie.
One country, two systems. That's the model China set up to govern Hong Kong, and the same one it someday wants to apply to democratic Taiwan. But almost no one here wants anything to do with it.
It won't work. We are against it. We want the rule of law, but they are a totalitarian regime.
China claims Taiwan, even though the island has ruled itself for more than 70 years. While many support closer economic ties with Beijing, polls suggest an overwhelming majority oppose a setup like Hong Kong's.
We want to protect ourselves, and we want to make sure that the Chinese way of dealing with Hong Kong does not happen to Taiwan.
Taiwan's government has been outspoken in support of the Hong Kong protests.
And we are watching very carefully, and I'm sure the people here in Taiwan are also watching very carefully on how the Chinese government is dealing with Hong Kong. We are very concerned that the Chinese government might try to crush the protesters in a more violent way.
As Hong Kong becomes more violent, some in Taiwan are offering more than just symbolic support. This footage, shared with VOA by activists, shows residents donating helmets, which are in short supply in Hong Kong. So far, the group has sent more than 600 helmets. A small but growing number of Hong Kongers have also moved to Taiwan. Among them is bookseller Lam Wing Kee, who was detained by mainland Chinese agents but escaped to Taiwan on bail.
Of course I miss Hong Kong, but I'm happier living here.
Lam ran the Causeway Bay Books Store, which sold books critical of China's leaders. He was among five Hong Kong booksellers who went missing in 2015. Lam is trying to reopen the store in Taipei, but has no plans to return home.
They can just disappear you for no reason. Where will you be safe? I can tell you that if in the future Hong Kong is still ruled by mainland China, not a single Hong Konger is safe.
Taiwan's president has offered to take in some Hong Kongers on humanitarian grounds, angering China. It's not clear how many have taken up that offer, as Taiwan lacks a formal process for asylum. But it is clear that both Hong Kong and Taiwan are staring down Beijing, and in some ways, helping each other as they do it. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Taipei.
Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam says the government will formally withdraw an extradition bill that sparked 3 months of growing and often violent pro-democracy demonstrations. In a videotape message released Wednesday by her office, Lam said she was withdrawing the bill to fully allay public concerns. The bill would have permitted criminal suspects to be sent to mainland China for trial in courts controlled by the ruling Communist Party. Lam said she wants to restore peace and order to Hong Kong. Wednesday's surprise decision meets one of five demands made by protesters. Those include an independent probe into allegations of police brutality and the long-stated goal of greater democracy for the Chinese-controlled territory. But pro-democracy legislator Claudia Mo told reporters that the decision to pull the legislation was too little, too late. Wednesday's announcement comes just days after Lam was heard on an audio recording obtained by Reuters News Service. In it, she told Hong Kong business leaders that she had caused a huge havoc when she introduced the extradition bill that sparked the protests. In the recording, she can be heard saying, "If I have a choice, the first thing is to quit." Protest leaders took the remark to mean that officials in Beijing would not permit her to resign.
But will she quit? And will the Hong Kong government accede to the protesters' remaining demands? Joining us on VOA Asia is Christopher Ray, professor of modern Chinese literature and the associate head of the Department of Asian Studies at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. He joins us on Skype. Chris, thanks for being with us. Do you think the Hong Kong government will indeed relent on any of the other demands of the protesters? And that, of course, includes Carrie Lam stepping down.
It remains to be seen. I think that the formal withdrawal of the bill for good is a positive step. But overall, her response has been very underwhelming. And this is a leader who has already lost the confidence of the Hong Kong people. And will she make any further concessions? I think she'll essentially have to if she wants to remain in office. Of course, she could serve out her term and have a terrible reputation in the history books if she does not have an independent investigation into police brutality or meet the other demands of the protesters. She's kind of created this crisis of her own accord, right, where Beijing is going to be mad at her if she makes some decisions, and the Hong Kong people will be mad at her if she goes in the opposite direction. If she wants to make a positive impact for Hong Kong, she will have to do something that's really radical, and this includes universal suffrage. And as a first step, right, if she wants to restore any confidence in her government, the police brutality associated with these protests has been quite horrific. Right. This goes beyond the tear gas, beyond the rubber bullets. Some of the latest reports are we even have video of police in riot gear sexually threatening protesters. So the police force, right, and the government that stands behind it, its reputation is in tatters now. And so this, 4-point statement that Carrie Lam has put out is like a Band-Aid, where Hong Kong has internal bleeding and broken bones. So I think she needs to do something far more radical to restore any confidence.
The protesters have already said that they are calling for more protest if indeed that does happen, presumably this weekend. How do you expect the police to react?
I think the police need to be taken in hand by the civilian government and told that this use of excessive force is absolutely unacceptable. Will that happen? I don't know the inner workings of the Hong Kong police force. I don't know who is in charge. But I think that they will need to exercise restraint because the pendulum has already swung to an extreme of violence, and it really needs to swing back. And will this happen? I really don't know. I think that the protesters would prefer peaceful negotiation and discussion. I don't think any of the protesters want violence, but some of the violence you've seen on both sides has come from this escalation that has really been needless.
How much control do you think Beijing has over Carrie Lam?
I think pretty significant control. And she is not directly elected by the Hong Kong people. She is really very closely tied to Beijing, serves at Beijing's behest. She has not yet shown any significant independence or autonomy that would contravene that view. So that's why I think she really does need to do something radical that shows that her primary loyalty and allegiance is to the Hong Kong people.
This is almost a restart of all of these. At least a lot of people are hoping it is a restart of the protesters protesting a few things and the government reacting. What's the possibility of that happening?
Well, this has been an extremely well-documented protest. We have video, we have transcripts, we have public statements, right? The world has been paying very close attention to this. And so it cannot be swept away, right? We have a significant archive that people will be debating about for years. And so the question is indeed, how do we move forward? And I think we don't move forward naively. So the Hong Kong government should be under no illusions that this simple 4-point proposal by Carrie Lam is going to be enough to undo the damage that's been done so far. So that would be one. Another would be for essentially an abject apology on the part of the government and on the part of the police for a lot of the brutality and a lot of the condescension towards the Hong Kong people that we've seen so far. This is a really unique and special place, right? This is a global city. This is not just a Chinese thing, right? This is a human rights and civil liberties thing. And so I think that's one reason that people across the world really should be paying very close attention.
Christopher Ray is the professor of modern Chinese literature and associate head of the Department of Asian Studies at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the voanews.com website.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Jim Stevenson with Ira Melman.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is concerned about the U.S. administration's asylum policy, which she says may be in breach of international human rights law. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
The UN rights chief does not question the sovereign right of the United States or any other country to adopt migration and asylum policies that are in line with their national interests. But she says the laws must be in keeping with international human rights law. Michelle Bachelet says policies that restrict migration must be in compliance with standards that do not put people's lives at risk. She notes migrants unable to enter a country through a legal crossing point will find other routes, which could put them in danger. She says she has some reservations about the new Trump policy of keeping asylum seekers waiting on the Mexican side of the border until their cases come to court. Before anyone is returned to Mexico, she says the United States must study the case to determine whether the person is a refugee and entitled to international protection.
We believe that the policies, measures that have been adopted by many countries, and in the case of the United States, some countries like Central American countries, are putting people in more vulnerable situations.
Bachelet tells VOA she is opposed to the U.S. policy of family separation. She says she has received reports that family separations also are occurring in Mexico. In July, she notes, the U.S. House Oversight and Reform Committee said that hundreds of children have been separated from their families since the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy was enacted in June 2018.
We do believe that the arbitrary separation of families constitute an arbitrary and unlawful interference with family life and a grave violation of the rights of the child. It's against all the legal conventions and international human rights law and the laws for the child.
Bachelet says detaining children for longer than 21 days is both unconscionable and unlawful. She says she has heard it could take up to 2 years before asylum cases are adjudicated. She calls this a matter of great concern and hopes the process can be speeded up. If not, she urges U.S. authorities to ensure that asylum seekers are protected while they are waiting. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Online cooking videos are an indispensable tool for at-home chefs, but using a mobile device in the kitchen can get messy. A New York University student has solved the problem by turning the traditional apron into a remote control for devices. Tina Trin reports.
Anna Oh is a novice when it comes to cooking, so she does what many do to improve their culinary skills: watch online videos. But things tend to get messy.
It was annoying to touching my iPad frequently with my greasy hand.
Oh came up with a hands-free solution she calls the Recipe Controller. It's a smart apron prototype that lets users navigate online videos without touching them.
You can use this apron like a remote controller to control your video contents while cooking.
The apron uses an Arduino microcontroller, a single-chip computer that has Bluetooth connectivity. Everything is connected, even the apron's print.
This is looks like just normal print, but actually this is conductive fabric, so I program it.
The apron relies on soft circuitry, the use of alternative materials to create electrical circuits instead of traditional methods like wiring and soldering, making them easier to integrate into fabrics and wearables.
Sewing the sprint to the metal slab with the conductive thread, so it's connected each metal slab with each print.
Each print is programmed with a different function, and tapping them will pause and play videos or rewind and forward them. Need to raise the volume? Simply slide this pole left or right. The rope that it hangs on is conductive. O considered incorporating spoken commands, but the technology turns out to be less helpful in the kitchen.
Hey Alexa, Siri, pause the video. It's relatively long, but tapping is more simple.
For O, the best creations are equal parts design and tech. The electronic module detaches so that the apron can be thrown in the wash.
I want it. My apron looks like just normal apron.
It's a recipe with delicious results. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Stay with us. There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Welcome to the world of insect cuisine. The UN says billions of people around the world already eat bugs, and farming insects is much better for the environment than raising cattle or pigs. Now, a pop-up restaurant in South Africa is trying to make eating insects a gourmet experience for people who may still find the idea a little creepy.
Yeah.
VOA's Haresh Arabasadi digs into this story.
In this bag, Chef Mario Barnard holds what he calls the food of the future.
It takes a very small land and very little water to make a lot of insects.
Barnard first tried grilled scorpions and crunchy insects mixed with garlic and spices on a trip to Thailand. He says he was grossed out, but inspired to make his own dishes highlighting bugs.
It didn't taste like insects. It tasted like croquettes. It tasted like potato and chickpea, a slightly nutty, spicy into it, which I believe is the insect.
Barnard says achieving the right flavor is an exact science. It starts well before lunch crawls into his kitchen.
They will get the taste from whatever they eat. So if it's compost, they will get like this rotten vegetable taste. So that's why they have a very specific diet, and we have somebody farming it for us. Yeah.
Scientists tout insect-based food as sustainable, cheap, and high in protein, fiber, and minerals.
A lot of foods that we're eating right now is too much chemical and stuff, so that's killing our body. But this is a natural food, so.
The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says in no uncertain terms, farming bugs as food is better for the planet than raising traditional livestock.
As global population grows as well, agriculture land becomes less and less. The more people we have, it's good for the environment, and also we try to steer clear of animal cruelty, and it's the food of the future.
If any of this has you hungry for bugs, Barnard's pop-up restaurant, The Insect Experience in Cape Town, is due to stay open until November, well beyond the original closure date. Haresh Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Have you ever eaten bugs?
I have, Ira. They were good, crunchy.
I might have tried them a couple of places where I once lived, but I just ate it once or twice. People can't live on Mars yet, but an agency in Spain is letting visitors pretend to. The group has replicated the Martian environment in an underground cave. VOA's Lavitsa Hoch reports on how the project works and who comes to experience life on the red planet.
Scientists, architects, and developers have converted a large cave deep in the mountains of Cantabria in northern Spain, about 90 kilometers west of Bilbao, into a human colony with living conditions similar to those that would be needed for life on Mars. They say the lack of atmosphere, extremely low temperatures, and presence of cosmic rays on the red planet would probably force new societies to settle below ground. Ares Station offers adventurous travelers an opportunity to try it. Before entering the cave for 4 days and three nights, participants have to undergo 26 days of online training and 3 days of intensive training in the regional capital, Santander. When they enter Ares Station, they become astrolanders, which means pioneers facing the unknown.
What we were doing for all the time there, it was troubleshooting and solving all problem by problem just to make experiments working, another experiments working, something else working. And this was really great because this is what I like.
Astrolanders live in protective habitat, but have to venture out to explore, carry out spacewalks, experience the feeling of weightlessness, and learn how to grow food in specialized laboratories.
It was a super great experience to be on Mars for 4 days. We were in a cave now, and then we always had those great moments every day where you went on an EVA, it's called an extravehicular activity, where you go out of the habitat where we were sleeping in, and then you were going out in the cave, and it just looked like Mars. Because on Mars, you're allowed to live in the lava tubes, so it's perfect.
A maximum of 10 people can take part in each mission, which is not cheap. The price of $6,600 per person may seem astronomical, but for many, the experience is worth it.
An experience that totally takes you out of your comfort zone. It is another world. You have to adapt, change your mindset. And everything that is ordinary, you have to learn how to do it differently from what you used to do on Earth. It really is another world.
Astroland says its Ares station has carried out its first mission successfully and is now open to new groups of explorers. Zlatica Hoc, VOA News, Washington.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Jim Stevenson with Ira Melman. The Taliban claimed responsibility for an explosion in Kabul late Monday, just hours after a U.S. negotiator shared with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani key details of a deal that would see thousands of American troops leaving Afghanistan. An Afghan government spokesman said the blast in the Green Village compound, which houses international organizations and guest houses, killed at least 16 people and wounded 119 others. Police said they had rescued 400 foreign nationals from the complex and transferred them to a safe place. Earlier, U.S. officials said they had reached a draft framework agreement with the Taliban that will require some American troops to vacate five military bases in Afghanistan within 135 days of the signing of the document. Currently, 14,000 U.S. troops are deployed to Afghanistan, and there are seven known U.S.-run bases in the country. Michael Kugelman is the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked him if the Taliban's continuing displays of violence were conducive to a peace agreement with the United States.
Well, unfortunately, this is the cruel logic of the Taliban. I know that as these negotiations have gathered steam with the United States and as they've gotten into their more advanced stages, the Taliban has been ramping up its violence. So this is not the first time in recent days that we've had a mass casualty attack in Afghanistan. I mean, basically what the Taliban is trying to do here is strengthen its position in talks. It wants to essentially send a message to the United States of, look, we can do this whenever we want. We're very strong. And if we don't get the type of deal that we want, we're just going to return to the battlefield and do more of this. In other words, the Taliban, by staging these horrific attacks like this, by ramping up violence, is trying to extract more concessions from the United States at peace talks. So, yeah, I mean, it looks bad. The optics of it are atrocious. But this is what the Taliban does. And I should say as well, I mean, trying to look at this in a big picture, the United States has also ramped up its own offensives. It's been ramping up its kinetic activities, working with Afghan forces to push back against the Taliban on the battlefield. So both the U.S. and the Taliban have been ramping up the violence, so to speak. But with the Taliban, of course, what you have is the way they showcase their violent capacities and abilities is by staging these horrific attacks, even as we get so close to a deal with the United States.
Which one would think would mean that a deal isn't completely done, right?
Well, I mean, I think that it seems like every day for the last 2 months, there's been some type of media headline saying U.S. and Taliban very close to a deal, and yet then the deal is not finalized. I think it's going to be some more time. Clearly, one thing that's very clear is that President Trump himself has not signed off on the deal. So Zalmay Khalilzad, the top U.S. negotiator, has been very public in laying out many of the details of this draft deal. But he himself has said on a number of times that this is not going to be final until President Trump has been able to sign off on it. And I think that the U.S. is trying to do some damage control. Its relationship with Kabul is very bad, and I think that what the U.S. wants to do is to try to get as much buy-in and consensus from the Afghan government as it can. So Khalilzad was in Kabul recently to talk to the Afghan leadership about the deal, and as I understand it, the Afghan government's going to have a few days to sort of look over the agreement and get back to the Americans. I know that the U.S. is trying to share the deal, the draft deal, with NATO partners as well. So I think it's going to be a bit more time, but I actually think they're fairly close to a deal. I think it's more an issue of when you get the buy-in that you need from the Afghan government and from other NATO countries. I don't really think there has to be that much more negotiating between the U.S. and the Taliban. At the end of the day, they both want a troop withdrawal agreement, and they've almost got one.
But is there any trust on either side?
Well, there has to be trust in the sense that there were 9 rounds of talks, which is quite extraordinary, and they did reach a draft. They reached an agreement in principle, but certainly there's a lot of suspicion. I think particularly on the U.S. side, I do think, though U.S. government officials would not state this publicly, I do think there's concern that the Taliban would not be willing to abide by the commitments and the promises that it makes in a deal with the U.S. And I think the main expectation of the Taliban is that it would, A, deny space to international terrorists, B, agree to a ceasefire, and C, agree to start talking with the Afghan government and other Afghan stakeholders. The deal itself would stipulate that all 3 of those things be done on the Taliban's part, but certainly there's some concern that the Taliban is just going to thumb its nose at those obligations and think that it can get a troop withdrawal deal that entails American forces leaving, which would give the Taliban a tremendous battlefield opportunity to just go out there and try to overthrow the Afghan government by force, which it's been trying to do for many years.
So what is your prognostication here?
I think there will be a deal signed between the U.S. and the Taliban. I think that the problem will be pivoting from the troop withdrawal deal between the U.S. and the Taliban to the broader negotiation between the Taliban and the Afghan government and other Afghan stakeholders. I just think it's going to be very difficult to get the Taliban on board with that idea. I think it's going to be very difficult to get the Taliban to agree to stop fighting or at least to declare a temporary truce, even though those are the obligations in the deal with the United States. You know, the Taliban for such a long time has wanted to destroy the Afghan political system as we know it and take over and impose a government along the lines of what it had in the late 90s when it ran Afghanistan for the most part, which was basically a system that reflected the most stringent manifestations of Sharia law. So for me, it seems sort of hard to believe that the Taliban would all of a sudden be willing to support the political status quo and work out some sort of political settlement in which it would share power with the current government. It seems hard to believe.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
With many of the top stories from the past week, we continue with VOA Asia Weekend. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam said Tuesday she has never asked the Chinese government to let her resign to end the city's political crisis. She was responding to a Reuters report about a voice recording of her saying that she would step down if she could. Reuters correspondent Michelle Hennessy has more.
Your answer does not arise. I have never tendered any resignation.
Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam was forced to respond to a Reuters special report on Tuesday. The report included leaked audio from a private meeting. She's heard telling a group of business people she would resign if she could and that she's stuck between two masters.
For a chief executive to have caused this huge havoc, it's to Hong Kong is unforgivable. It's just unforgivable. If I have a choice, the first thing is to quit. Having made a deep apology, is to step down. The room, the political room for the chief executive, who unfortunately has to serve two masters by constitution, that is the Central People's Government and the people of Hong Kong, that political room for maneuvering is very, very, very limited.
Lam's resignation is one of the key demands of protesters who want her gone after she tried to pass a hugely unpopular extradition bill that would have seen suspects sent to mainland China for trial. It's since morphed into calls for the people of Hong Kong to be able to choose their own chief executive. Rolling protests show no signs of losing steam, despite more than 1,000 arrests since the outbreak of violence. On Tuesday, Lam said Beijing still trusts her government to solve this three-month crisis and that they'd never prevented her from stepping down.
In a private session, I just attempted to explain that as an individual, given the very difficult circumstances, might be it was an easy choice to leave. But I told myself repeatedly in the last 3 months that I and my team should stay on to help Hong Kong.
Later on Tuesday, China's Hong Kong and Macau Affairs Office said anyone who wants to achieve universal suffrage in the Chinese-ruled city will get nowhere, and reiterated Beijing's support for the embattled Carrie Lam.
Michelle Hennessy of Reuters. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi is urging Indian authorities to take steps to ensure that no one in the northeastern state of Assam is rendered stateless. Nearly 2 million people were recently struck off Assam's citizenship list and are at risk. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency does not question India's sovereign right and authority to establish who is an Indian national. But it says the risk of people excluded from the citizenship roll and becoming stateless is of great concern. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balash tells VOA all means must be taken to ensure this does not happen.
What we are asking India is to ensure that adequate access to information, legal aid, and legal recourse in accordance with UNHCR's mandate and international standards is followed so people are not left without a nationality.
People have 120 days in which to prove their citizenship before regional quasi-judicial bodies. Those deemed to be illegal immigrants can then appeal to higher courts. Balash says it is too early to know how this will work out. But he says he worries many people who do not have access to the right information and documentation and do not have the financial means to pursue the appeals process may end up stateless.
We are urging the government to take steps that mitigate the risk of any individual being left stateless as a result of this exercise. We have seen some encouraging statements from the Ministry of External Affairs that they will make sure that all the people who have been excluded have access to their rights.
The UNHCR warns any process that could leave nearly 2 million people in Assam state without a nationality would be a big blow to global efforts to eradicate statelessness. The agency estimates up to 10 million people are stateless worldwide. Stateless people lack all basic rights of citizenship. They have no right to an education, to work, to health care, or to register births or marriages. The UNHCR is calling on Indian authorities not to detain or deport anyone whose nationality has not been verified. India has defended its decision, with news reports saying the government carried out the exercise to detect and deport undocumented immigrants from Bangladesh. Some critics say the move is an attempt to deport millions of minority Muslims, many of whom came from Bangladesh. The Bangladeshi government has said it will not accept anyone deported from Assam. Bangladesh currently hosts more than 1 million Muslim Rohingya refugees whom the government of Myanmar has stripped of their rights of citizenship and rendered stateless. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, a rush to get into a store and no rush to visit a region. There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter, where advocates and opponents debate a critical issue of the week. From Afghanistan to Zimbabwe, from the White House to Capitol Hill, we bring you the story behind the headlines. If you have a comment on one of our programs or ideas for topics, please write to us at Encounter, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Encounter, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the Internet, send us an email to encounter@voanews.com. Once again, encounter@voanews.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
It's the end of another week. Sit back and relax as we continue with more VOA Asia Weekend. The large U.S. retail store opens with much excitement in China, while unrest and uncertainty drive tourists away in Kashmir. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
U.S. retail giant Costco recently opened its first store in China. The new Costco store will be targeting China's growing affluent middle class, who know the Costco brand from international travels. Julia Zhu is a Costco member.
So whenever I come back to China, I would bring many boxes of things back. Now Shanghai has one. I came here immediately to get a membership card.
Analysts say Costco faces a tough road and will be operating in an environment where many other international retailers have failed. Richard Zhang, Costco's senior vice president, says that the company has taken time to make sure that the market is mature enough and that consumers know their brand. Representatives say Costco's bulk buying strategy and practical approach will also help them avoid the pitfalls other businesses have faced. Costco will also shift its buying strategy when necessary. Richard Zhang is Costco Asia's senior vice president.
Some items would really get too expensive, so we would turn to other regions. For example, some fresh produce that we originally get from the U.S., now we would turn to Australia.
Costco's new business venture is launching in a still tense trading environment between the United States and China. It's expected that by the end of the year, the trade dispute will affect nearly all imports and exports between the two countries. In Kashmir, tourism has dropped after India revoked the region's autonomy, suspended phone and internet access in the region, and sent in government troops to control the region. According to government figures, the number of visitors dropped from more than 1.3 million in 2012 to 850,000 in 2018 in the Indian part of Kashmir. Many locals who make a living off of tourism are suffering. Bashir is a houseboat owner.
90% is tourism.
90% of Kashmiri people earn through tourism, so they're dependent on tourism. That's true like this, and they've trapped us. Even on Eid, we couldn't buy anything. We couldn't buy any vegetable. We couldn't buy any food for our family. We couldn't celebrate.
The estimated $500 million tourism industry is central to Indian Kashmir's economy and employs roughly 100,000 people. Once known as the Switzerland of the East, Kashmir's tourism continues to suffer amid ongoing tensions between Pakistan and India. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
Far from just playing backgammon or shuffleboard, today's senior citizens may want to renew their gym memberships. A new small sample study says that older adults benefit from the types of exercise just years ago thought too risky for their bodies. VOA's Arash Arabasadi stretches and warms up for this story.
In the Chinese capital, senior citizens shatter the stigma of old and frail.
I have nothing to do since retirement, so I just come here and exercise.
Yu Song Wang is a retired farmer. He's one of hundreds of older adults stretching and working out at the Temple of Heaven in Beijing.
I do not stay at home because there's nothing to do. I swim for an hour at the gym, then I work my muscles, and then billiards, whatever makes me happy.
Researchers say previous thinking that exercise is too taxing on seniors' bodies, even those who are relatively healthy, is outdated thinking.
By far the best strategy to protect against disease and age comorbidities is to adopt regular exercise.
Resistance training leads to increased muscle mass and bone density, both important for the well-being of aging bodies. Dr. Lee Breen from the University of Birmingham.
We set out to understand whether individuals who've been highly active for all their lives, or master athletes as we call them, whether their muscles responded any better to a single bout of resistance type exercise compared to your average Joe, your sedentary older person. And what we found was that their muscles responded identically to this bout of resistance exercise.
He says people in their 50s and 60s should structure 2 or 3 days each week for strength training.
We saw about a 20% increase in the muscle building response to resistance training, and that was fairly consistent across all of our older, untrained individuals in this study.
Breen says a gym membership is great, but that even body weight exercises reap benefits for seniors they studied.
The children have grown up. My grandchild has already gone to school. I am over 80 now. What can I do? I just exercise and try not to trouble my children.
The Birmingham study looked at 15 men between 65 and 80 years old. Breen says the university plans a separate study for women later this year. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
A peculiar form of body art is gaining popularity in New York City. It's protest body art, where people paint their bodies not with pictures and innocent images, but slogans aimed at fighting divisiveness. Nina Vishneva has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
New York protesters fighting against divisiveness have chosen a new, peculiar canvas for their slogans, their own bodies.
If it's too thick, it's like going to waste a lot of money. If it's too thin, you'll notice because it's see-through.
Andy Golub is a body painter and artist. His specialty, slogans and images that fit exactly between the shoulders.
We feel a certain amount of shame, a little fear, because, oh my God, I'm not good enough. And so the idea is if once you believe that, well, I'm just a human being, like I'm not supposed to be perfect, I am good enough, then all of a sudden we love ourselves. And when we love ourselves, that's only when we can love each other.
New York officials initially took a dim view of his work, and Golub was arrested for public lewdness in 2011. Those charges were eventually dropped, and these days the police don't mind, as long as the body painting is part of an organized demonstration. Artists, bankers, office workers, people of all occupations and social statuses come here to make a statement. They all share Golub's belief that human bodies are more powerful than paper and banners. His parents are his biggest fans.
Well, he's been different since the day he was born. Very special.
Yeah, we have 3 kids. He could be crazy, and he could be the most charming guy in the world.
One of the least popular colors, black. Golub mostly works in bright colors, so his models can portray unity and optimism.
Why am I here? I believe in spreading unity. I believe in spreading the fact that nobody needs to be divided. No matter what lifestyle or whatever, who they happen to be.
Golub says he wants to change the way people view the human body.
This is America!
And his models say it changes the way they view their own bodies. For Nina Vishneva in New York, NRI's VOA News.
With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Stay with us. There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
We continue now with VOA Asia Weekend. Officials at Arizona State University in Phoenix want to know what happened to 9 of their students who were arriving from China for the latest semester of classes. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with a spokesperson from the school, Brett Hovell.
So over the last couple of weeks, as students were starting to come back to school for the start of the fall semester, 9 Chinese students were stopped at Los Angeles International Airport by Customs and Border Protection, interviewed, had their phones taken away and searched, and then were denied entry to the country. They have all returned safely to China at this point. What is perplexing about this is that we don't know why this has happened. We've gotten no information from Customs and Border Protection. We have tried to work with all levels of U.S. government, including sending letters to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the acting Secretary of Homeland Security. We have not gotten an official or unofficial response from the federal government as to why this happened.
What have you asked, and how many times have you asked, and who have you asked?
Primarily, what we're looking to find out is what are these students accused of that would keep them out of the country, and is there any way we can rectify the situation so that they can come back and resume their studies?
What have you been told by Customs and Border Patrol?
Nothing. We have gotten the same generic statement that Customs and Border Patrol needs to patrol the border, and there's a whole bunch of reasons someone might be denied entry. We've gotten the same basic statement that they've been sending to the media. There is no detail as to what has occurred here.
Is there anything in what these students have either done or said or put online or anything like that that might cause this action to send them back to China or not let them into the country?
You know, I certainly don't know every detail of everything they've ever said or done. And of course, I guess anything is possible. But there was a rumor that one news organization picked up that it might have had something to do with academic dishonesty. I can tell you that at ASU, we take those issues very, very seriously. And in this situation, all of the students were academically eligible to return to Arizona State University.
What had they been studying, and what have they been studying?
Well, they're still studying. As a matter of fact, we're going to be working with them to take some of their classes online. We're going to be working with them. Many of their professors are helping with independent studies so that they are able to continue advancing at Arizona State University. A couple of them, in fact, were on track to graduate this fall. One of our students actually was only 9 credits away from being able to graduate. So this is, you know, I mean, it's would never be good when this happened, but it seems particularly cruel and troublesome at this particular moment. These are all undergraduate students. To your question, they're studying a number of different things. It's not all one area of study. There are some business students. There are some engineering students. I saw one is studying supply chain management, which is actually a really interesting program we have at ASU, and obviously at a number of other places too. There's no particular pattern that we've been able to discern there either. What I think I want people to know is that we have a large number of students from China studying at the university. A large number of international students come to Arizona State University, as well as universities all over the country. And we find those types of partnerships where we are helping to provide education and we are learning as much from our students in many cases as they are learning from us. We find that very useful and positive, and one of the things that makes studying at a great American university as great as it is. And so we remain committed to working with these students and working with future students who desire to come to ASU.
Ira Melman speaking via Skype with Arizona State University spokesman Brett Hovell. As this story developed during a U.S. federal holiday weekend, VOA Asia was not able to reach the Customs and Border Patrol for a detailed comment, but the agency did issue a brief statement to the Arizona Republic newspaper Friday, saying the Chinese students were deemed inadmissible to the United States based on information discovered during the CBP inspection. A worsening drought is pushing parts of eastern Australia toward a fish Armageddon, according to senior politicians. Vast numbers of native fish died suddenly at Menindee, 100 kilometers west of Sydney, in January. In a desperate attempt to stop more mass fish kills, authorities are planning to set up Noah's Ark-style sanctuaries for threatened fish species. Phil Mercer casts his net for details from Sydney.
With not much rain on the horizon as well as record low river levels, there are fears eastern Australia will witness more fish dying at a higher rate than last summer. A million fish died at Menindee when a sudden drop in temperature caused algae to die. As the algae decomposed, oxygen was sucked out of the river, suffocating marine life. Farmers and conservationists accused the state government of allowing cotton growers to drain too much water from the Murray-Darling River Basin, one of Australia's key waterways. Officials, though, blamed a worsening drought. They've announced a multi-million dollar fish rescue plan to help avert an ecological disaster. The New South Wales Agriculture Minister Adam Marshall says vulnerable native fish will be relocated from the river to hatcheries for safety.
I can't sugarcoat it. It will be the equivalent of a fish Armageddon in New South Wales this summer. And I say that based on all the evidence. We will use hatcheries like this to create a modern-day Noah's Ark for native fish species in New South Wales.
The fish will be kept in captivity until river conditions improve. Environmental groups, however, say changes are needed to water policy and management to improve flows to ensure living, functioning rivers. Paul Humphreys, an ecologist at Charles Sturt University, believes the Noah's Ark plan probably won't work.
It's a terrible choice because it was actually floods that caused the problem that Noah was trying to solve, and here we're talking about droughts. It's also, I think, a problem because Noah was essentially being instructed by God, and I think in some ways we're playing God with this sort of stuff.
Australia is the world's driest inhabited continent. Scientists are warning that climate change not only threatens national treasures such as the Great Barrier Reef, but also critical river systems that sustain the nation's agriculture. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
There's more VOA Asia Weekend coming up.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
This is VOA Asia Weekend. From e-rickshaws to cabs, commercial vehicles in India are leading the way in bringing electric vehicles into the mainstream. Anjana Pasricha reports the country's first electric cab service has launched in the Indian capital, New Delhi, as the government makes a big push toward electric mobility.
Mehak Chopra prefers commuting in app-based cabs so that she can read or catch up on work. She calls one from an all-electric cab service so that her ride does not add to the fumes from the millions of vehicles that clog one of the world's most polluted cities.
Any kind of step is a good step, be it planting a tree or, you know, taking electric cab, and rather not using my private vehicle, which is a petrol, and using electric cab. Yeah, I do think that I am actually contributing towards better Delhi.
The startup Blue Smart Mobility launched its service this year as tax incentives lower e-vehicle costs and make them viable. The government has also promised subsidies for charging stations and batteries.
In the long run, I mean, if you do the math, it checks out. I mean, the returns on electric mobility is about 3 years. Much better for the environment. At the same time, it's much more efficient, to operate an electric car. So it's much cheaper to run the service.
Optimistic that electric cars are the future, Blue Cabs plans to have 1,500 taxis by the year end.
They want to shift to cleaner mobility, healthy food options, likewise healthy travel.
Some customers hope it will nudge private transport in the same direction.
When a lot of cabs are there which are viable, then the customer, the private car owner customer will also start to purchase it.
Cabs are not the only electric vehicles to make a debut, as India pushes to increase their numbers to meet two goals: tackle the deadly smog that shrouds its cities and reduce expensive oil imports. More than 1 million electric rickshaws have mushroomed in towns and cities, the largest number in the world. The inexpensive cost per ride has made them hugely popular with poor and middle-income commuters and led to brisk demand for manufacturers of these vehicles.
Because of large population and large requirements of last-mile connectivity, e-rickshaws are very, very suitable for that kind of usage. And that is why you see a geometric progression in growth.
And the affordable $2,000 price tag provides an option for those seeking a livelihood in the city.
I was a graduate but did not get a job, so I bought this e-rickshaw. It helps me run my household expenses.
Some rides are noisy but cheap, others more pricey and comfortable. But for a city whose dense traffic contributes to toxic smog, it is a ride in the right direction. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
An unusual regatta took place in Northern Virginia as thousands gathered in Reston to watch a cardboard boat race. More than 150 participants used duct tape, cardboard, and their imagination and engineering skills to stay afloat as long as possible. Maxim Moskalkov went to Reston to watch the extraordinary regatta.
Tensions were high as more than 150 amateur boat builders launched their cardboard craft into a lake in the northern part of Virginia. The idea was to build a cardboard boat, fast and durable enough to win a race across Reston's Lake End. But really, just staying afloat was a win.
And here they come to the dock, here they come!
The regatta was organized by the local Reston Historic Trust and Museum.
Well, this is called the Lake Ann Cardboard Boat Regatta, where people build life-size boats out of cardboard and duct tape, and they race against each other. And it's a project that we started two years ago. It's our third one. And we wanted to build a community event that involved families and local businesses and nonprofits that everybody could enjoy together.
There are teachers and priests, office workers and artists, adults and teenagers here. Out of 73 cardboard boats, only 55 met the specific criteria to enter the race. The only materials builders could use were cardboard, duct tape, glue, water-resistant paint, and special coating. More than 2,000 spectators came to watch.
We just like doing fun and crazy stuff, so we heard cardboard boat regatta. And we said this year we want to build something new. We want to improve what we did before. And, oh, by the way, we'd like to try paddle wheels.
First of all, we're here to win, obviously, right? Like, you can tell. It's very fun. Like, look around. You don't need a real reason to come here and do this. It's just fun.
Kristin and Cole represent one of the local churches at the regatta.
We based our boat off of the Noah's Ark. We built it. It was us two and a few of our friends from the church. We basically just used cardboard and tape and paint and paper animals that have kind of fallen off now.
Dragons and unicorns, cartoon characters and celebrities. Every boat was definitely unique, if not seaworthy.
I tell you what, there are a couple that are really marvelous. There is one that big catamaran, and it has painted on the side the picture of each beetle. They're going to have the song Yellow Submarine going on while they're rowing.
Steering a cardboard boat is not as easy as it might seem at first.
Yes, it was hard, but it was
very
fun.
Difficult. Super fun, though.
Yes.
Definitely recommend
it. And we stayed afloat.
Yes.
That's all we cared about.
Even the boat that managed to sink in the most spectacular way won its own honorary award, the Titanic Award. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Reston, Virginia.
This has been VOA Asia Weekend, a compilation of some of the stories presented throughout the past week on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check out VOA Asia online at voanews.com.